Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment production. You can find the show on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Blue Sky and Mastodon. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or collaborating, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of war, genocide, violence, rape, sexual assault, child abuse, slavery, and human trafficking.
Of arms I sing, and of that heroic son, of his wondrous deeds, and of his victories won, of his prudence and his valor shown when, scorning the hate and envy of his fellow men, unmindful of the dangers that beset his way, performed deeds most heroic in his day. Gaspar Perez de Viagra, Historia de la Nueva México, 1610. Throughout an inhospitable winter, the people who lived in the Tigüex province suffered at the hands of a bloodthirsty madman. But when spring came, someone finally provided a solution. A man, likely a migrant from the Great Plains, came forward and told the elders and war chiefs about his plan for a clever ruse. He would lead the strange white men and their horrifying beasts into the middle of nowhere. Once they were all dead from starvation, he would return, and the people of Tigüex would be free. It was a long shot, but anything seemed preferable to rape, theft, cultural genocide, and forced conversions. It was not the first time the Pueblo world encountered Spanish mercenaries, but this entrada, or expedition, would leave an indelible mark on the Puebloan peoples. The Pueblo world, prior to European arrival, was one which was in flux. New enemies were ever present, and intra-Pueblo rivalries often led to open warfare amongst the Puebloans. More than a few Pueblos were abandoned prior to European arrival. As we have learned, the ritual abandonment of Pueblos was often practiced, so these may not have been violent or sudden abandonments, but methodically planned ones. One of the main places this smaller abandonment affected was the Perijito Plain, which was previously home to thousands of people. This likely occurred between 1400 and 1450. Elsewhere, people were experimenting with smithing, as the natural abundance of coal and copper in the area allowed the Puebloans to readily exploit these resources. Once the Europeans arrived, Mexican silver was introduced to the area, and the Puebloans became master silversmiths. The foray of Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca in 1527 brought Europeans out to the southwest for the first time. Cabeza de Vaca was part of an expedition to Florida and the Gulf of Cheap Eggs, originally headed by Panfilo de Narváez. Almost immediately, the 600-man column was beset with issues. They were eviscerated through privation, starvation, and disease. The men were left for dead by the Spanish Navy, so the few survivors, headed by Cabeza de Vaca, made their way overland back to Mexico. In the end, only four members of the original group remained alive. Among them was a man named Esteban, who was trafficked by the Spanish. He acted as the official interpreter between the natives and the Spanish. Along their journey, they encountered a tribe of Cabeza de Vaca called the Bison Hunters. These may have been members of the Great Sioux Nation. He wrote in his journal that the natives used, quote, emeralds made into arrow points, unquote. When asked about these, quote-unquote, emeralds, which were likely just copper ore, the Bison Hunters explained that they traded eagle feathers in exchange for the arrowheads with the people from the south. When asked if these people had possessed gold or silver, the bison hunters responded that the people there didn't care about either of these precious metals. These two small pieces of information were enough to start a rumor, which would span decades and lead to the colonization of the Southwest by the Spanish. The entirety of colonial Mexico now believed that there were 7 cities of gold scattered across the Southwest. Cabeza de Vaca was obviously proud of his tall tale. He even added the fabled cities of gold to his family's coat of arms. Once the Spanish authorities realized that the people to the north lived in towns and villages, they quickly separated the nomadic peoples of the plains from these town dwellers, whom they called Indios Pueblo, hence the modern term Puebloan. This term is obviously insufficient to describe the vast array of cultures and linguistic groups who live alongside one another in modern pueblos. The Spanish called their nomad counterparts Indios Barberos, and they equated these native peoples to be little more than animals. The Spanish would often launch slave raids against these nomadic peoples, which only increased their quote-unquote warlike disposition and brutal retaliations against white colonists and settled Puebloans alike. The pace of this enslavement only increased with Spanish hegemony firmly in place. Additionally, the Spanish exacerbated the intensity of domestic slavery which was practiced by the native tribes. For example, the Utes and the Comanche, to varying degrees, frequently raided the Navajo for slaves. The Navajo, in turn, sometimes practiced enslavement as well. The practice of enslavement would spread to various tribes and would eventually lead to some native support of the Confederacy during the United States Civil War. Stephen Lexon has confirmed that some low-level form of domestic enslavement was occurring both prior to, during, and after Spanish dominion. But he stresses that the chattel enslavement practiced by the industrial United States, Great Britain, etc., was far more brutal than native enslavement, which was a form of domestic servitude practiced in most quote-unquote intermediate societies throughout the world. Although we won't be discussing all of the cultural and linguistic differences present amongst modern-day Puebloans, we will attempt to very briefly go over some of the major differences amongst them in order to understand the rainbow of cultures which are present today and those that were around in the mid-16th century. First off, the Zuni speak Zuni, which is a language isolate, meaning there are no languages like it in the world. However, Craig Child says that one language specialist claimed the cognitive structure of the Zuni language can be compared to Japanese. As of 2015, there were almost 10,000 native speakers. Next, the Tinoan language group is immensely sophisticated. This group was the main focus during Coronado's 1540 to 1542 expedition. Amongst the Tinoan language group, 4 major sub-dialects are spoken, each of which has its own regional variants. In total, almost 6,000 native speakers still exist. The Keres, or Keresan language, is completely distinct from the Tinoan language. Amongst those speakers, Eastern and Western varieties are distinguishable from each other. This language grouping is one of the largest, with over 13,000 native speakers. Finally, at Hopi, a Uto-Aztecan language is spoken by about 6,000 people, pointing to a combined lineage of northern hunter-gatherers and southern nobility. All these languages are endangered, save for Keresan, and countless other language branches have died out entirely. Piro, for example, was once spoken in a number of pueblos, but the speakers have all passed on or incorporated certain phrases into modern-day Tinoan. In total, the Puebloans number 75,000 today, which is 5,000 less than their original pre-Columbian population estimates of approximately 80,000. Back in the 16th century, in spite of the gold fever which swept the colony of Mexico, it took years for another expedition to be launched. This one was led by the Franciscan friar Marcos de Niza. Amongst the party was Esteban, working once more as the expedition's official interpreter. They arrived near the modern-day pueblo of Zuni, and almost immediately a culture clash, or outright piggish behavior by the Spanish, resulted in violence and death. The story goes that the Spanish were at first treated respectfully and brought food and drink. But when Esteban began demanding native women for his quote-unquote use, the people of the pueblo became enraged and killed Esteban and his entourage where they stood. The remainder of the expedition fled from Zuni as fast as their legs could carry them. This unfortunate encounter between two oppressed peoples bred animosity between the two, and it is one of the main reasons an animus exists against black people, which is still prevalent among certain members of the Zuni tribe, as well as the Pueblo peoples in general. Upon his return, the expedition's leader claimed to have been to at least to one of these cities of gold, which he called Cibola. This is likely a bastardization of the Zuni word for bison. He said the other six cities lay beyond Cibola, and they were ripe for the taking, if only someone was strong-willed enough to force the native peoples to heal. Before we talk about the landmark Entrada of Coronado and his mercenary conquistadors, we should spend a moment discussing the country from which they hailed and the changes that had taken place in Spain since the first conquests of the Taino and Aztec or Mexica peoples. Since those two bloodbaths, the Spanish crown had actively attempted to repair its image. They attempted to instill humanitarian boundaries upon their soldiers in the New World. This had little effect, as the distance involved was great, and the bureaucracy which would be necessary to keep subordinates in check was near impossible to facilitate. This turned governors of colonies like Cuba and Mexico into powerful, semi-independent rulers. They were primarily concerned with land and resources, with religious conversion and cultural dominance coming in a distant third and fourth on their list of priorities. The people in charge of these expeditions were not honorable Spanish knights. Jim Cornelius writes that they used violence as, quote, a tool against the natives should they resist Christianization or not lead them to silver and gold, unquote. In short, today we would call these people war criminals, or patriots, depending on what flag was posted behind them, or what hat they had on their head. Regardless, in April of 1540, Francisco Vázquez de Coronado set out with a huge force of as many as 3,000 men. The vast majority of them were the famed Aztec Jaguar warriors and other native allies. As with any discussion about colonization, it's important to note that the role of Spain's native allies was crucial to their ability to successfully colonize these peoples. It is due to these collaborators that the Spaniards were able to conquer nearly two continents. God, guns, and germs undoubtedly played a huge part, but the manpower provided by Mexico was indispensable as well. Divide and conquer was the name of the game, and the Spanish were incredibly adept at exploiting native rivalries to suit their own ends. Once they got the people to turn on each other, the Spanish would be able to exploit the land and resources of quote-unquote New Spain for their king. Alongside the armed contingent of the expedition were upwards of 500 war horses and thousands of heads of livestock. Both of these would have been oddities to the Puebloans, but new evidence shows that horses were being traded along native routes since their first reintroduction to the continent by Cortes. On July 7th, the Coronado expedition arrived in the village of Jawicu, who were Zuni speakers. The expedition quickly realized the fabled golden city of Cibola was a medium-sized run-of-the-mill pueblo with a few thousand people living in it. They cursed the friar who had lied to them, and he was soon sent packing back to Mexico. In spite of having strict orders to the contrary, violence quickly broke out between the Puebloans and the Spaniards. The pueblo was in the midst of a grand celebration, and when they were confronted by the Spanish army, they figured this was one of the slave-raiding parties which had routinely decimated the Apache and the natives of western Mexico. Coronado then captured the pueblo, but only after being severely wounded in the running fight. Jawiku was never the same. When Oñate finally conquered Nuevo Mexico in 1598, the priests he left in charge at the pueblo erected a church on top of the ceremonial kiva of the Puebloans. David Roberts says that this was, quote, a vivid demonstration that the Catholic faith must supplant the quote-unquote sorcery of the Kachinas, unquote. The end of the Pueblo of Jawiku came violently. In 1676, the men were away in the fields when the Apaches stormed the settlement and killed, or hauled away, all the women and children. The surviving men had nothing left, and they drifted to different remaining pueblos and tried to start again. Back in 1540, Coronado and his men were clearly getting desperate. He sent a detachment of men west under the command of García López de Cárdenas. This detachment ran right up to the Grand Canyon, which hampered their progress significantly. Next, it moved to southern Arizona, where it met the Sobaipuri Odham in battle. The Odham's charge was so rapid that the Spanish had no time to respond with their arquebuses and the small cannon they brought. It seems they had overpacked one of their cannons with powder, which resulted in the barrel exploding. The other was left on the ground, where it was uncovered 500 years later as a testament to the prowess of these indigenous peoples in warfare. Meanwhile, Coronado was traveling along each side of the Rio Grande, searching desperately for gold and committing near daily atrocities against the natives. It was only when winter set in and the army demanded supplies from the people of Tiguish that the Spanish became utterly desperate. In each pueblo, Coronado would demand shelter and supplies for his men, and upon refusal, the pueblo was plundered and burned to the ground. Numerous pueblos suffered this fate, while those which remained standing were depopulated as more people left the Tiguex region to escape the horrors of the Spanish interlopers. The people of the Tiguex, largely Tewas speakers, united in a final show of defiance against the Spanish. They amassed their forces in the highly defensible pueblo of Mojo, whose location today is unknown. They withstood a Spanish siege, which lasted several months. Approximately 400 Puebloan defenders died here. The rest were enslaved upon their surrender. It was after these events that the plains migrant, El Turco, dubbed by the Spanish for his Mediterranean features, volunteered to lead the Spanish on their wild goose chase, which began this episode. He likely led them over the Rockies, into the Texas Panhandle, through western Oklahoma, and into Kansas. It wasn't until they arrived at this final destination that the Spanish caught wise to the so-called Pecos Plot, laid by El Turco. They tortured him into confessing, and then garroted him. Upon Coronado's return, the Puebloans at Jemez, Towa speakers, took up arms against the Spaniards, which led to a pitched battle that resulted in a Spanish victory. The defeated Puebloans refused to submit, however, and they took up defensive positions inside the Pecos Pueblo, which was one of the largest in the entire Pueblo world. Another siege followed, but this time the will of the Spaniards to continue fighting was completely sapped. They returned to Mexico in 1542, completely worn out and with nothing to show for their efforts. Coronado was absolutely humiliated by his failure to bring back any gold, and the news of his atrocities shocked even the most ardent Spanish inquisitor. Official charges were brought against Coronado for his barbarous treatment of the northern pueblos of Tiguex. These charges amounted to nothing, as he was eventually acquitted by the Spanish judicial system. Coronado died in 1554, and the failure of his expedition was so immense that the Spanish refused to send another for several decades, deeming any venture into these northern deserts to be a waste of time and resources. It was during this time that Puebloan society was able to repair itself and experience their last few years of independence from the Spanish. The Puebloans likely thought that they were safe. The white sorcerers from the south had finally come to realize that the yellow stones that they salivated over were not present in the Pueblos. The Puebloans' most precious stone was turquoise, which was imported from the east, which the Spaniards routinely scoffed at and threw aside, deeming it worthless. In spite of Coronado's failure to acquire riches, the fabled Seven Cities of Gold remained at the forefront of the minds of lustful colonists. Another entrada would not be attempted for almost four decades. However, in 1581, a small expedition set out to make contact with the Puebloans once more. Upon their approach, entire villages would flee to the hills, evidence of how traumatized these peoples were by Coronado's atrocities. This expedition's main contribution to history was naming the area they explored San Felipe del Nuevo México, soon to be shortened and then anglicized to New Mexico. The few friendly natives they encountered were amicable enough, but the Franciscan friars who traveled with the expedition were absolutely horrified at the cultural practices of the Puebloans. The snake dance especially aggravated their Christian sensibilities. The murder of Friar Juan de Santa Maria also deserves recounting, as it aptly illustrates the attitude of the Puebloan peoples towards these colonists and the religious zealots who followed them. Santa Maria was a part of this small 1581 expedition, and he decided to stay amongst the Puebloans and convert the quote-unquote heathens into quote-unquote good Christians. Reverend James H. Dufori explains how Santa Maria met his maker. Quote, "Much fatigued by crossing the mountains, the good father laid down to rest. The enemies, the Puebloans, were at hand. Cautiously they went up to the flank of the mountain and detached a huge boulder, which, falling upon him, crushed him beneath its weight," unquote. David Roberts comments that, quote, "dropping a big stone on a sleeping man, ethnographers would later learn, was the prescribed Pueblo fashion for dispatching a witch," unquote. The next major entrada, which was attempted in 1583, was headed by a rancher named Antonio de Espejo. He was on the run from inquisitorial justice after he supposedly murdered a fellow rancher. He likely hoped that his crime would be pardoned by the powers that be once the fabled cities of gold were located. Espejo kept extensive diaries on his travels throughout the Pueblo world, which provided some of the first true insights into these people, as well as the first Spanish opinions of them. Like in 1581, entire pueblos were abandoned as the Spanish approached. Espejo and his men responded by setting fire to the empty pueblos and arbitrarily prosecuting and executing Puebloans who didn't flee. Espejo argued that if he and his men did not, quote, "punish the natives somewhat, they would become insolent and try to kill us," unquote. Approaching the Acoma Pueblo, Espejo's men were set upon by the natives, and the Spanish retaliation was swift. They burned the settlement to the ground and destroyed the cornfields. Unfortunately, the troubles for those living at Acoma would only increase with future expeditions. Following this devastating raid, Espejo and his party arrived at Hopi, where they learned that Franciscan friars who had stayed behind decades ago had since been murdered. Supposedly, the two friars at Hopi were set upon by the entire pueblo. One had his head smashed in with a wooden block. The other was riddled with arrows. Their bodies were subsequently tossed unceremoniously into a raging river. In response, the pueblo, with many of its inhabitants still inside, was set on fire, and an unknown number of people perished in the blaze. The main purpose of Espejo's expedition was to find serviceable gold or silver mines, and in this, he had completely failed. He tried to coerce colonial officials back in Mexico into funding a follow-up expedition which would lay down permanent routes in Nueva Mexico, but he died en route to Spain while attempting to plead his case before higher authorities. A third entrada was initiated illegally by treasure hunters. A fourth was sent to arrest the third, and the fifth ended after the two leaders killed each other and the rest of the party was wiped out in the wilderness. It was clear that the Spanish were becoming more and more dead set on claiming all of Nueva Mexico for the Spanish king. In order to do so, Spain needed a conqueror, and their man ended up being the Mexican-born Juan de Oñate y Salazar. His father, Cristobal, was one of the first millionaires in colonial Spanish history, and he is regarded as the founder of the richest silver mine in all of Mexico, located in Zacatecas. Cristobal was born in 1504 in the Basque country of Spain, and he arrived in Mexico in 1526. In either 1550 or 1552, his wife gave birth to Juan. Juan's early life was fraught with violence. It was said that at the age of 10, he was fighting off Chichimeca natives with a musket and sword. He refused to be outdone by his father. Oñate founded a silver mining town all his own called San Luis Potosí. It was through his management of these profitable mines that he gained the ear of colonial authorities in Mexico City. It was also here that he married Isabel de Toloso Cortés de Montezuma, the granddaughter of Cortés and the great-granddaughter of the Aztec emperor Montezuma. He arrived in Nuevo Mexico in 1598 with the goal of completely converting the Indios Pueblo. In reality, his goals were the same as the past entradas: discover resources, exploit them for personal enrichment, and subjugate the people to get their free labor. In April, he unilaterally declared that all of Nuevo Mexico was now a part of the Spanish Empire, saying that Philip II was now sovereign of, quote, every creature, spiritual and corporeal, rational and irrational, from the highest cherub to the lowliest ant and tiniest butterfly, unquote. In each pueblo, he would proclaim this good news. However, he did so in Spanish, ensuring that no one in the pueblo had any idea what he was raving about. The entrada was relatively small when compared to Coronado's. There were only about 150 soldiers, an unspecified number of native allies, and 560 colonists, destined to be the first generation of Spaniards in the newly annexed colony. Carrying this throng of humanity were 80 ox-drawn carts. This caravan supposedly stretched for 2 miles, and the going was always slow. Regardless, after entering a pueblo and recanting the annexation decree, Oñate forced the entire village into a mass conversion. On July 11th, he entered the pueblo of San Juan, today Oque-Owinga. It was here where he constructed the administrative capital of Nuevo Mexico, San Gabriel, soon to be moved further south to Santa Fe. He claims most puebloans went along with his annexation and conversion decrees willingly at first. However, things rapidly changed for Oñate. In October, he and his entourage marched on Acoma. At first, he claims his men were offered food and drink and the Puebloans readily accepted, Spanish religious conversion and overlordship. He stayed at Jawiku, west of Acoma, and awaited his Maes de Campos arrival, but he failed to show. Juan soon discovered that his Maes de Campo and 10 of his men were killed by the Acoma. This was beyond a professional blow to Oñate, as the Maes de Campo who was killed was also his cousin. What exactly happened to these men remains up for debate. If one were to passively accept the Spanish side of the story, the noble Spaniards were set upon by bloodthirsty natives who had planned the double cross from the beginning. Gaspar Perez de Viagra writes that an Acoma war chief named Zutacapan rallied the anti-Spanish forces to his side, saying, quote, "Tell me, how could there be a greater misfortune, a more terrible disgrace upon all of us, than to submit to the slavery and subjugation offered us, and be obliged even to feed these strangers? I swear by all the living gods that not a man should remain alive, rather than submit to this tyranny." Unquote. The Acomans, led by Zutacapan, then engaged the Spaniards in dreadful hand-to-hand combat. Urging his followers into the maelstrom, Zutacapan supposedly shouted, quote, "Death! Death by blood and fire! Death to those thieves who have so arrogantly dared to set foot in our lofty fortress!" Unquote. Finally, Viagra says, the Maes de Campo was dispatched by Zutacapan in single combat. How exactly a Spaniard was able to interpret this speech and the following battle description, especially considering he was not present when it occurred, is unclear. More than likely, the Spanish completely fabricated this description of the event that took place. Another story purports that a Spanish soldier stole or attempted to make a transaction for 2 turkeys, resulting in his death and the death of his fellow soldiers. At any rate, this unfortunate incident would lead to decades of suffering, which are still etched upon the minds of many Acomans. Oñate demanded justice and declared, quote, "The Acomas must at once abandon the fortified place in which they live. The Indians must deliver up the bodies of those killed, their personal belongings and weapons. After the Indians have been removed from the pueblo and placed under custody, you will send back to the pueblo as many soldiers as you deem necessary. Burn it to the ground and leave no stone on stone, so that the Indians may never be able again to inhabit it as an impregnable fortress." Unquote. As 1599 began, the military contingent of Oñate's expedition prepared for a fight which would determine the next 80 years of history for Nuevo Mexico. The Acoma had a clear terrain advantage. Their sky city was 500 feet in the air and only able to be assaulted via hand and toe holds, which were precarious enough for seasoned Puebloan climbers, let alone armored conquistadors. Regardless, the Spanish had an overwhelming technological and organizational advantage. If the fight dragged on, there was little hope the Acoma would be able to resist. They found the Acoma determined and ready for battle. The entire Sky Island was brimming with warriors, chanting their war songs and taunting the Spanish onward. They were armed to the teeth with bows, war clubs, obsidian blades, and the handful of Spanish swords and muskets they took off the bodies of the dead white men. They were determined to live freely or die trying. Starting on January 22nd, Acoma was slowly annihilated by the Spanish. Feigning a frontal attack, a smaller detachment circled around Acoma and entered the Sky Island from the rear, completely upending the defensive advantage of the Acoma. Rushing to defend their rear, the Acoma were unable to dislodge the Spanish, whose firearms were deadly accurate at such close range. Realizing all was lost, the Acoma went on a frenzied killing spree, going house to house and wiping out their own families, rather than submit to the Spanish. Spanish interpreters pleaded with the Acoma warriors to cease the bloodshed, if only for the sake of their wives and children. The Acoma warriors replied that, quote, they and their women and children wanted only to die, and that the Spaniards are scoundrels, unquote. Finally, the Spanish decided to burn the rest of the pueblo, engulfing those who did not die in battle in the flames. The wreckage of Acoma was complete. Amongst the rubble, the charred and bleeding remains of at least 600 to as many as 800 Acoma lay in heaps. Another 500 Acoma were taken prisoner and were sent to Mexico to stand trial for their crimes. The trial of the 500 Acoma was a complete farce, but Oñate did at bare minimum hear the testimony of several native participants in the battle. They all told him that the violence was started by or because of the Spanish. Their testimony was largely discounted. Others said that many of the Acoma refused to fight at all, hoping to be spared from Spanish wrath. The defense attorney for the Acoma, Alonso Gomez, argued passionately on behalf of the 500, even saying that it was the Acoma who should be compensated by the Spanish crown for their loss of property and loved ones. His arguments fell on deaf ears. The punishment dealt out by Oñate was draconian and depraved. He decreed that every male prisoner over the age of 25 was to have his right foot cut off and was sentenced to 20 years of slavery, a virtual death sentence. The girls and women between the ages of 12 and 20 were likewise given 20 years of slavery. Children under 12 were made quote-unquote servants in the haciendas of Mexico. Finally, two Hopi men, who were by chance visiting the pueblo at the time of the attack, had their right hands chopped off and were told to return home and let their people know what would happen to them if they tried to rebel. Eventually, many Acoma would escape, be granted leniency, or find their way back to their home, but an entire generation of people were left scarred physically and emotionally forever. The fact that Acoma still exists today is a testament to the stalwart determination to survive that has been demonstrated time and again by the Puebloan peoples. Additionally, the Acoma have managed to blend their native Kachina religion with that of Roman Catholicism. This is exemplified by the San Esteban del Rey, a Puebloan mission built some years after the massacre. Tradition speculates that the Acoma were forced to carry the logs used in the convent's construction for dozens of miles and were not allowed to let the beams touch the ground. In spite of this, the mission remains standing, even after the Pueblo Revolt of 1680 destroyed most of the Spanish architecture which had existed prior. The first few years of Nuevo Mexico were fraught with colonial infighting, factional violence, and increasingly paranoid behavior on the part of Oñate. He was arbitrary to the extreme, and by 1600, most colonists were fed up with the meager existence they were eking out. Oñate started seeing enemies everywhere, and he went to violent extremes to quell his fears, even having two of his most trusted lieutenants murdered. By 1601, both Puebloan and Spanish colonists alike were suffering due to a food shortage. Refusing to listen to the people he governed, Oñate took off on another expedition, this time to the Gulf of California. While he was away, most of the colonists in San Gabriel took the opportunity to flee the province. When they arrived in Mexico City, they brought with them the stories of violence and corruption Oñate engaged in daily. This was enough ammunition for charges to be brought against him. He resigned as governor and was convicted for a litany of abuses, including murder. His sentence? Permanent banishment from the colony he founded. Returning to Spain a destitute man, Oñate died in 1625. Oñate shared the fate of many explorers and conquistadors of his day. He died broke, yearning for gold. He died a disgrace. Yet for some reason, he was honored after his death as a quote-unquote true trailblazer and a Hispanic visionary. In fact, in 1992, In celebration of the anniversary of Columbus's quote-unquote discovery of the Americas, the convicted murderer Oñate was honored with a massive equestrian statue at the entrance of the New Mexico Cultural Center. Years later, in 1998, Hispanics living in New Mexico recreated Oñate's entrada, complete with 16th century regalia and gear. Unsurprisingly, the march's organizer claimed he was, quote, unsure about how to include New Mexico's Indian pueblos into the project, unquote. In response to the proposed celebrations and marches, several activists took matters into their own hands to protest the hero worship of a genuine scoundrel. In the dead of night, on January 5th, 1998, these activists, who called themselves the Brothers of Acoma, symbolically cut off the right foot of the Oñate statue. A week later, the Oñate statue had a new right foot, courtesy of a displeased original artist who said, quote, what Oñate did might seem cruel and unusual, but what about what the Indians did to him, unquote. That speaks for itself. The incident demonstrates clearly the cognitive dissonance that exists within colonizers and their supporters, as they misinterpret and wrongly justify these imperialist and damn near genocidal acts. This dissonance has created a fork in the road of history and has unfortunately allowed misinformation and misinterpretation to grow exponentially within the stories of ancient peoples, especially native populations, as the quote-unquote winners always seem to push their stories into the limelight over the stories of the people they conquered. In order to understand history better, we need to accept the realities of history. Anyone who tries to sugarcoat history to make themselves look better or to justify some asshole statue being built is doing a disservice to the human story, the modern world, and the people who would benefit from learning our true history. We should study history not just to understand the past, but to question why and how we prevent it from repeating itself. The story of La Entrada demonstrates how easy it is to use violence to bring people to heal, as well as how damaging that violence can be. Not just for those who endure it directly, but also for those who live on and come after. The Puebloan way of life did not cease with Spanish arrival. It was undoubtedly upended, but it survived. Instead of the lavish, open ceremonies the Puebloans held in the past, their culture and religion would be forced underground, but it still burned as brightly as ever. Thanks to their secrecy, the Spanish authorities had no idea the level of animosity the native peoples still had regarding the Spanish occupation. The Spanish believed the natives had been cowed and that they would never again threaten Spanish power in Nueva Mexico. They were about to realize how wrong they were. To hear what happened during the next 100 years of Puebloan history, you'll have to wait for the next episode of Turning Tides. Plots will be hatched, revolts started, and independence attained. In the end, a relatively small group of people beaten down by an empire will prove that through determination, patience, grit, and comradeship, any obstacle can be surmounted. Thank you all so much for listening. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone. I hope you all have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. We would also appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen, and share the show with your family and friends. It really helps us bring the show to more listeners. Thank you so much for the support, and thanks again for listening.